This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the opioid crisis continues to confound us as a nation. First, there is the human toll. Some 60,000 Americans died from overdoses in 2016 alone. And now the Council of Economic Advisers say that in 2015, the crisis cost the U.S. economy more than $500 billion in medical costs, lost wages.
Part of that number is the lost productivity from the millions of Americans who are grappling with substance use disorder. And that, of course, is to say nothing of the toll that it has taken on families and really on entire communities. This is just a very grim story.
Oh, it really is. And we're starting to see an interesting trend emerging in the medical community. Far fewer opioids are being prescribed. And in some cases, practices are eschewing all narcotic prescriptions. It's creating a new issue for a large swath of patients who suffer from chronic pain. Many of these patients who are reliant or even dependent on opioids for true pain management will be looking for alternatives.
Well, I think, Mark, we know that just say no is not really a realistic answer. There are people out there who are suffering and who need help in dealing with both acute and chronic pain. But we're learning through our own experience here in our organization that it takes an integrated approach to be successful, an integrated approach to pain in terms of medication, but also mindfulness meditation, chiropractor and physical therapy interventions, yoga, other therapies are helpful and effective in working with patients who have chronic pain. But that also takes a real commitment on the part of the provider and the whole practice, I would say, and the right kind of training. And that's something many practices just don't have.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there does seem to be momentum growing across the healthcare landscape to scale back significantly on opioids. And that will bode better for future clinical outcomes. Meanwhile, our guest today is a big proponent of scaling back in the healthcare space.
Daniel Wolfson is the Chief Operating Officer of the ABIM Foundation. He'll be talking about the Choosing Wisely campaign. That's a campaign that was launched 5 years ago to reduce the amount of waste in American healthcare, a very costly problem for our country, and we look forward to hearing from him.
And also, Laurie Robertson, who we look forward to hearing from, is the Managing Editor of FactCheck.org, and she is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we'd love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Daniel Wolfson in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. President Trump's pick for HHS secretary was on the Hill, answering questions on a number of topics, though it wasn't the official hearing for the former insurance industry executive Alex Azar. While Azar spent a decade as a top executive at Eli Lilly, it was a period of unprecedented growth in drug prices under his tutelage. Skyrocketing drug prices are a leading driver of America's expensive healthcare system and have proven of late to be fair game from both sides of the aisle. Speaking of drugs, the opioid crisis will be a leading item on the HHS secretary's agenda if he's approved. The president has declared the crisis an emergency. Azar, if approved, will have to initiate policies to address the crisis, which led to over 60,000 deaths in 2016 alone and is said to be costing the American economy over $500 billion per year, according to the Council of Economic Advisers. Azar can take a number of steps to undermine the law further. There are just a couple of weeks left for open enrollment under the Affordable Care Act, and efforts are amping up in certain parts of the country. California is actually outspending the federal government in messaging to the masses in that state that the open enrollment period has been cut in half by the Trump White House. Trump administration slashing the marketing budget as well by 90% this year to market healthcare.gov. That's the federal exchange. Also slashed money for navigators that were there to assist those helping them sign up for health care in the online marketplaces. While the federal government has slashed the marketing budget to $10 million nationally for 39 states, California is spending an excess of $111 million investing in online advertising, radio and TV campaigns, billboards, even artistically designed wall murals to get the message out. California is one of only 11 states in the District of Columbia who have their own insurance marketplaces. Some slightly promising news on the advent of World AIDS Day, December 1st, 2017. According to a report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the time between HIV infection and diagnosis and treatment has been shortened by 7 months, which is in turn having an impact on overall infection rates. Of the just less than 40,000 new cases diagnosed in 2015, the cases were diagnosed on average 7 months closer to their actual date of infection. CDC Director Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald noted the slight improvement in the infection rates. It was 50,000 new cases in previous years, can be attributed to quicker diagnosis, but there are still pockets where co-infection is higher among young men of color in this country, IV drug users, a group that has grown steadily in recent years with the opioid epidemic. And gut milk? There's also a higher likelihood you've got food allergies of some kind. While the incidence of severe food allergies have risen across the country for a variety of foods, most notably nuts, it's milk that seems to have the biggest overall impact. In 2016, milk allergies led to more people requiring medical intervention than any other allergy. Those suffering with peanut allergies, however, though smaller in number, have a higher incidence of anaphylactic response, causing severe reactions requiring outpatient medical intervention. A Kaiser Health News report stated that, according to the FDA, most food allergies, more than 90%, were linked to 8 foods, milk, eggs, fish, shellfish, tree nuts, peanuts, wheat, and soybeans. Sensitivity to milk, though, can lead to more insidious, lifelong ailments, such as gastrointestinal irritation and disease and other chronic complaints requiring prescriptions or other costly medical interventions. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Daniel Wolfson, Chief Operating Officer of the ABIM Foundation, a nonprofit supporting organization of the American Board of Internal Medicine, which certifies physicians who practice internal medicine and its subspecialties. The ABIM Foundation is committed to advancing medical professionalism to improve care. Previously, Mr. Wolfson served for nearly 2 decades as the founding president and CEO of the Alliance of Community Health Plans, the nation's leading association of not-for-profit and provider-sponsored health plans. He co-sponsored the journal Effective Clinical Practice with the American College of Physicians. Mr. Wolfson received his master's degree in health service administration from the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Daniel, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great to be back, Mark.
Yeah, 5 years when the ABIM Foundation launched a very ambitious project, the Choosing Wisely campaign, which we love so much. And it really was shaped by this just ever-growing medical cost, $3.5 trillion of expenditures, and really adding cost and unfortunately, it seemed to be waste. And Choosy wisely enlisted the support of many medical societies to commit to reducing the overprescribing of antibiotics and other drugs. Take our listeners back to the start of the campaign and what your specific goals were when you launched the Choosing Wisely campaign, and who were your partners when you initially set out?
So when we last talked, Mark, there was 9 specialty societies developing 45 recommendations regarding what tests and procedures had risks that outweighed the benefits. And we've tried to start a conversation between patients and physicians about the notion of unnecessary tests and procedures, particularly based on the evidence that was being produced by the specialty societies. We also partnered with many patient groups, and we went from 9 specialty societies to today having 80 specialty societies and over 500 recommendations.
Wow, that's impressive.
So we wanted to start a conversation about the issues so patients and physicians could choose the best option for them, knowing what the evidence was and the recommendations of specialty societies. So not only are we spread throughout the United States, but it's in 20 countries internationally, all with the name of Choosing Wisely, with the same kind of principles of physician-led, consumer participation, evidence-based, and multi-professional. We also have non-physician clinician organizations like nurses, OT, PT, chiropractors, and optometrists. So we've really expanded the team.
Well, Daniel, the foundation has just issued a 5-year report on the Choosing Wisely campaign, and I want you to know that here in our home state of Connecticut, it has been on the healthcare agenda kind of front and center ever since you started. I think, Mark, that's partly due to the great work of Dr. Steve Smith, who works with us here at the Community Health Center. But in your report, you note that there's been some impressive results from certain sectors, though still some significant challenges in the quest to reduce wasteful spending in healthcare. And you've got some real pockets of improvement. And I think our listeners would love to hear about some of those successes, how we're starting to see a practice shift and a cultural shift in the right direction.
So, you know, I think patients are beginning to talk about more is not always better. I think that patients and physicians are hooked on new technology, and I think there are questions that patients are now giving to their physicians about, are there other options? What are the costs of this procedure? Then we're seeing a shift in physicians as well, as the specialty societies have given them a strong message that, no, there is unnecessary care, and we need to get rid of it because it doesn't have any benefit and it potentially puts people at harm. Of course, culture and attitudes are really important. But then what you have to see is some kind of reminder to the physician and maybe the patient as well that there is this evidence that when they're ordering a test, think twice. One is that you've been given data by your hospital or your group or your clinical practice that show your use of these recommendations compared to your peers. And that creates a kind of peer pressure. Or you might get a reminder in your medical record that says antibiotics are not really useful for sinusitis to remind you. Now, it's not an absolute, but there's this chance to have this conversation between patients and physicians. And, you know, the patient gets consumer-friendly materials about the recommendations as well. So both are equipped with the evidence, and it's really up to them to make informed decisions about what tests and procedures are really needed. But you're right, there's been lots of pockets of success. We've seen incredible reductions, for instance, in antibiotics, more than 20%. Out of 11 out of 14 grantees that we worked with, we've seen amazing reduction of lab work. You know, sometimes in hospitals, they'll order labs for every day. Need it or not, you'll get the same lab test. Mm-hmm. Telemetry is a machine that monitors the heart when you're hospitalized. Not every patient needs a telemetry machine. And why it's important is, I think, if it's unnecessary, why put the patient at uneasiness? And every time that machine goes off, and sometimes faulty, a nurse has to go and turn it off and check it. And they have to take the time and go down and look at the machine. It becomes a safety issue. So not only, you know, is it important to decrease some of these lab tests or drugs like benzoid, but, you know, it's the kind of the downstream effect of some of these tests and procedures. When you give somebody a sedative, particularly elderly, they're more likely to fall. So sometimes it's a cascade effect that occurs and increasingly puts the patient at harm. The harm of the test or the procedure, but what happens afterwards.
You know, Daniel, I want to pick up on a couple of things that you said. Patients saying that more is not better, conversations between the provider and the patients, and patients clearly are important. And when you think about the changes in healthcare, having the voice of the patient at the around the table is so important. So pull the thread for us on it. What is the role that patients are playing here? How are they a partner here and not just a recipient of some information by the provider, but how are you actively engaging them, educating them?
So the first thing we do is give them the recommendations and things that you and I can understand. And then, you know, in some practices, we provide posters that ask, you know, these 5 questions about, are there other options? Is this necessary? What are the costs? What would happen if I did nothing? You know, kind of watchful waiting. So equipping them with that information really puts the patient and physician on the same page. We've been at this 5 years. You know, it took us 30 years or 40 years to get here, and overuse that totals $210 billion a year. It's going to take some time for this sea change to occur, but we are headed in the right direction. And really, I think what we need to do is to gauge clinical practices and health systems and hospitals and really focusing on this and doing the kind of quality management, quality changes that mm-hmm. need to get done. Our goal is to get reduction, not to 100%, because some of these things are sometimes needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lower back pain, you shouldn't do a CT scan unless there is some red flags. Then you should do a CT scan. But beyond that, we hope that the reduction is dramatic. You know, financial harm is increasingly talked about, and I think you'll see that is a major issue in the coming years. You know, I got to do a shout-out to people in Connecticut. There is a Connecticut Choosing Wisely Collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually one of four statewide programs, and we're seeing statewide efforts. They're saying, no, this is a real safety issue, and we should be working together to get this problem solved.
Absolutely. And I wonder if we also still have the issue, even when care is necessary, of just the price of care. And, of course, we marked the passing of our good friend and renowned health economist, Dr. Uwe Reinhardt. Oh. And I am reminded of his paper, It's the Price is Stupid, in which he posits that Americans don't use healthcare services more than other industrialized nations, but everything here costs so much more, and the prices are often secretive and lack transparency. And, you know, as we see people increasingly having high deductible health plans, they're getting kind of a frontline sticker shock, certainly when they pick up pharmaceuticals, but also in their practices as they pay for diagnostic testing and the like. Are you doing any work looking at the problem of price transparency from consumers?
I also want to recognize the passing of Huey. He was a great man. But I do think it's both the utilization and price. When you don't use anything, the price is zero. And our utilization is 25% about what it should be. The campaign is really focused on use, and it's not focused on drug price transparency. But do I think that that is important? Absolutely. But I really like to frame it as financial harm. We have physical harm, and we have financial harm. Whether, you know, the costs need to be lowered or there needs to be more transparency, absolutely. I think we'll get better at the price transparency. It'll become more acceptable because it's bankrupting patients. We need two things in price transparency. One, we need the prices, and particularly the pharmaceutical prices, and I don't think we're that far away from that. And two, we need physicians to know how to talk about it. And that's where I see our role is having physicians be comfortable to talk about the costs. Like, here's some options. This costs this, this costs this. They're equally as effective. What do you want to choose? And to know when patients are, in fact, if you will, price sensitive, but physicians don't have the skills to talk about it and to help their patients navigate the price-cost landscape.
We're speaking today with Daniel Wolfson, Chief Operating Officer of the ABIM Foundation, a nonprofit supporting organization of the American Board of Internal Medicine, which certifies physicians who practice internal medicine. The foundation just released a 5-year report on the results of Choosing Wisely campaign, a coordinated effort across multiple medical disciplines to reduce wasteful spending. Boy, Daniel, I've been thinking with the Choosing Wisely program right alongside of the expansion to access to health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. We've been talking a lot about the Affordable Care Act from this volume to value. Maybe talk a little bit about what you see some of the benefits that the ACA has set in motion, and how does that sync up with the goals of Choosing Wisely?
So I often say that we had the right environment for Choosing Wisely. The ACA set out accountable care organizations and different alternative payment systems. So, okay, I'm a physician, and I'm now under some risk. Where should I start? And choosing wisely is, well, here are some recommendations from your specialty society about how you can lower unnecessary care, improve quality, and oh, by the way, it's going to be more affordable. So this movement from volume to value, I think, is just paramount to our success in the Choosing Wisely campaign and the sustainability of the healthcare system, ultimately empowering physicians and clinicians to have their own reins, that they control the expense and revenue side of healthcare. And in a fee-for-service system, all I really care about is producing more units. The mindset changes when you're talking about health and healthcare. This health system, $3 trillion. We have enough money in the system. We need to use it better.
Well, Daniel, we often look beyond the clinical excellence that we strive for. We look at two other things to advance the patient-centered approach to improving care. One of them is research, and that ensures that we can keep improving on best practices. And the second is training the next generation of healthcare providers. And you and your campaign have generated a lot of new research on identifying some of these drivers of overuse. And you've also partnered with an organization of young physicians who launched Costs of Care. So talk with us a little bit about this growing body of research that you're assembling and disseminating, and how you see this emerging generation of new clinicians tackling this challenge. Where do they go from here?
You know, Choosing Wisely is all about partnerships. And we've developed a partnership with Academy Health, a not-for-profit organization that tries to stimulate research, health services research, evaluating essentially what works in the reduction of overuse. So that's been a great partnership, and trying to generate the notion that this is a scholarly and important area to address. And it's been very interesting. University of Michigan is looking at how you think about de-implementation. Like, let's take a visit for diabetes, and what things would you want to reduce in a diabetic visit? So very, I think, important to think about different ways of de-implementation that usually have said how you do something more. On the training side, I think this is a real success story, primarily because of our partnership, but Cost of Care, some young physicians who have taken this on, and we've done challenges or competitions trying to highlight best practices, webinars, and there's been a book produced by this cadre of people about value-based care. And they have, again, spawned off young faculty just doing some marvelous work. Johns Hopkins now has a high-value healthcare alliance where they're bringing in academic institutions to talk about low-value and high-value. American College of Physicians has developed several curriculum. There has been a sea change, and I think we have a cohort now of 5 years, medical students graduating, residents graduating, and I think they think and act differently. It's going from why didn't you do that test to why did you do that test? And that slight cultural difference makes all the difference in the world about, you know, training and thinking about what is really needed. Those changes are occurring, and I find it very rewarding to see these changes occur.
We've been speaking today with Daniel Wolfson, Chief Operating Officer of the ABIM Foundation, about their just-released 5-year report on Choosing Wisely campaign. You can learn more about their work and access the Choosing Wisely report by going to abimfoundation.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at ABIM Foundation. Daniel, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare Today.
It's great to be back.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The Senate Republican tax bill includes a provision that eliminates the Affordable Care Act's penalties for most individuals who do not purchase health insurance. That would have an impact on the number of people who have insurance. But some Democrats have wrongly claimed that 13 million people would have their health insurance taken away from them. Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, for instance, said that repealing the mandate would, quote, boot, according to CBO, 13 million people from the health insurance rolls. That distorts what the Congressional Budget Office and Joint Committee on Taxation have said. The nonpartisan congressional analysts estimated that 13 million fewer Americans would have health insurance by 2025 without the mandate, with similar results if just the penalty itself were eliminated. But that doesn't mean that all 13 million would be kicked off their insurance plans. Many of them would voluntarily give up their health coverage. In 2025, if the mandate were rescinded, the analysts said, an estimated 5 million fewer people would be enrolled in Medicaid, 5 million fewer people would get insurance through the non-group or individual market, 3 million fewer people would get insurance through their employer, and as many as 500,000 fewer would no longer have some other form of health insurance. CBO and JCT say this would happen mainly because healthy people would be less likely to get insurance, particularly in the individual market where those without employer or government insurance buy their plans. With fewer healthy people in the market, premiums would increase, causing more people to drop coverage. The report doesn't say how many would willingly give up insurance and how many would be priced out of the market. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Fitness trackers have become all the rage, especially among upwardly mobile, fitness-conscious people seeking to monitor their own health and fitness goals. But another trend has emerged in the age of wearable devices. After a few months, about a third of users simply stop using them, leaving a lot of costly devices sitting on the shelf and not in use. The reality captured the imagination of Tufts University School of Medicine Professor Dr. Lisa Gualtieri.
I had read about the abandonment rate, and I thought, what if you could take all of these abandoned trackers and give them to the people who could benefit most from them?
She thought, what if we could get disinterested owners to donate their used fitness trackers and wearable devices to be a repurposed and donated to underserved populations?
A lot of the work that we've been doing has been with older adults, racial and ethnic minorities, and for a lot of people, the cost is prohibitive, so I think that that's a barrier.
So in 2015, she launched her nonprofit enterprise, Recycle Health, an online social media campaign to raise awareness for her program, which seeks donated wearable devices no longer in use to provide these expensive devices for free to those in need. She partnered with organizations working with low-income adults and those with mental health issues, seniors in fall prevention programs, and veterans as well. Her goal is to start collecting vital data on the deployment of these devices and the impact they may be having on behavior change.
What we do is talk to people about how active, how sedentary they are, and coming up with a reasonable and achievable goal where they might start off with 2,000, 3,000 steps as their goal, but they know how to make that higher when they're ready to.
So far, the numbers of donated devices have numbered in the low thousands. She's hoping to scale that number up significantly in the future and to expand their data collection on health outcomes for vulnerable populations. Recycle Health, a simple repurposing of personalized wearables, providing these tools for free to vulnerable populations, empowering them to engage in activities that can improve their own health, provide useful data on using these devices to improve population health. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.
is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.